Welcome to our podcast on IP Coffee. Today is the 30th of August, 2018. I'm Manuela Macchi. I'm a partner in the firm Kelty LLP, based in the UK and Ireland, and I'm also a trademark attorney. Today we have a guest interviewee, Ronald Coleman. Hello, Ronald.
Good morning, or good morning New York time, anyway.
Good afternoon, our time, who's kindly agreed to be on our podcast. So just a brief introduction of Ronald. Ronald is a partner and the chairman of the U.S. firm Mandelbaum Salzburg. He's a commercial litigator specializing in torts of competition, as well as in the use and abuse of intellectual property as a tool for competition. Ronald already enjoyed a solid reputation in the international legal community, but last year he was pretty much catapulted into fame in the IP world because of his success in the appeal in the trademark case Slant before the US Supreme Court. So most of our listeners will have heard of the case, but perhaps, Ronald, you could jog our memories and give us a quick summary of the key points of the case.
Certainly. Thank you very much for inviting me today. And I just want to make it clear, I'm the chairman of the intellectual property practice, not of the law firm, not yet anyway.
All right. Sorry about that. But, I promoted you inadvertently.
I appreciate it, though. The case involved the question of the American trademark registration law, which prohibited registration of any trademark that was disparaging. It could disparage a person or a number of other categories. If a trademark basically was a frowny, unhappy, not nice trademark, in theory, it was under the statute, it should not be permitted to be registered. The history of this statute does not seem to have much to do with civil rights. The application of this statute to groups of people, American Indians, or what Englishmen call Red Indians, or black people, or members of an ethnic or racial minority, were certainly not contemplated by the statute, which was passed in the post-war era by a Congress that was sitting in a segregated city subject to Black Crow laws, Jim Crow laws. There was no sense whatsoever that the Lanham Act should be a device for preventing disparaging terms or hate speech. Hate speech, of course, not being a term that existed at the time. It was a fairly recent application of this language, though, of trademarks that are disparaging not being registrable. And it was first applied in the context, for all practical purposes, of the Washington Redskins American football team. A group of activists, including some of them very good friends of mine, concluded that because some American Indians considered the term Redskins to be offensive or disparaging, the trademark should not have been registered. So there was quite a bit of litigation over that, lasting a good number of years. Meanwhile, my clients, an Asian American rock band, were trying to register their trademark for the name of their band, and the name of the band was The Slants. The Slants was meant as a reappropriation of an ethnic slur, concept of reappropriation, a very American concept. We're going to take what you called us and appropriate it as a point of pride. An excellent example for European listeners, and certainly for British listeners, would be the term Yankee, which was meant as a form of mockery. Yankee Doodle is not, that's little ditty that was sung by British troops around the time of the American Revolution, was not meant as a compliment. but it was taken up by Americans. Yes, we're Yankees, and we're gonna show you a thing or two. So the idea of the band was, you want to call Asian people slant eyes or slants, a term which I actually never heard before the band approached me. Go ahead, do it. We're going to show you a thing or two. Their registration was rejected. I was asked to get involved in the case after several rounds of administrative appeals. And after a number of years, it ended up before the United States Supreme Court, which in all probability liked the look of our case more than it liked the look of the Redskins case, and which decided that under the First Amendment, under the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, there was no permit for the government to make trademark registration decisions based on whether a proposed mark, or rather a trademark proposed for registration, was happy or sad or something else. That's the not so short version of the story.
Okay, thank you very much. So it's now just over a year since the Supreme Court decision was handed down. Do you feel the case has left a legacy? Is it being relied on as a precedent? Has it changed the landscape of, you know, how sort of trademark applications are handled at all?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that question, and they sort of go cut across different channels. As a matter of constitutional law, I'm told that people in law school are reading the case. It's something that's taught to students. It certainly is the United States Supreme Court's latest and greatest definition of how to apply the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment to government conduct, which is all that it applies to. So it's an important case in terms of constitutional law, and frankly, I would be surprised if there's another free speech case that is a unanimous decision the way our case, which is called Mattel versus Tam. Tam was my client. Mattel, at the time the decision came out, was the head of the United States Patent and Trademark Office. I don't know if there's going to be another unanimous free speech decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in a very long time. So
right. That's
certainly an important legacy. How has it affected the trademark practice? There are a handful of people out there who are trying to get rid of the remainder of Section 2A of the Lanham Act, which is the U.S. trademark statute. Section 2A not only prohibited disparaging trademarks, but also offensive or scandalous trademarks. The PTO made the argument that scandalous trademarks should follow if the Supreme Court were to agree with our point of view. I think that was a strategic or decision made by the PTO in the hopes that they would make the court realize that there was more at stake than disparaging marks. I don't think it's a particularly compelling logic, but so far everyone who wears a robe has taken a position, it seems, that the cases should follow. So it does seem that the world is not yet done with Section 2A. As a practical matter, for purposes of the trademark practitioner, someone who day in and day out is representing individuals and predominantly businesses in the business of seeking to register trademarks with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, it's not particularly relevant. Most people don't represent clients who want to register trademarks that would have been deemed unacceptable under Section 2A before, and they mostly are not doing that now. One thing that is probably going to improve matters is that once all the dust settles and all the Section 2A questions are answered, there'll be a better sense at the PTO of what kind of examination examining attorneys have to engage in. One of the arguments I have made, it wasn't really made very much on the legal side, but more on the advocacy and sort of public commentary side, including on my blog, was that the sorts of analysis that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, or PTO, was being asked to make and was making in these scandalous and offensive and disparaging cases was far beyond the competency of what we expect from a trademark examiner. They were doing historical and sociological and statistical analysis, stuff that was really, you know, in my view, beyond the competence of the typical examiner and beyond what Congress intended for examiners to engage in when considering a trademark. So if that is taken off their plate, I would think that that would be a source of relief at the USPTO. I could be right or I could be wrong about that. Yeah. But I think in the long run, that will actually have an effect on making it a little bit less politicized process and a little bit less complicated to consider trademarks for registration.
Right. So was the decision mostly welcomed by the IP profession in the U.S.?
That's a really good question. I think it's really close. Although we had many opportunities to speak before our colleagues in the IP bar across the United States to be on panels and to publish and to talk about this case, when we would poll audiences and when we would discuss this with IP colleagues, the feeling about our First Amendment argument was quite mixed. And I think it's fair to say that something very close to half fell on either side of the line.
All right, so it's quite divided, the reaction was quite divided. Okay.
I think it's divided, and I think the reason for that is twofold. One is that I think there's a certain component of the IP bar that thinks of itself as liberal and progressive, and liberal and progressive thought in America and Europe today is that free speech should take a back seat to being careful about how we make other people feel.
Right.
That hate something called hate speech is a thing, and that it's a dangerous thing, and we have to recognize it as a something in society that we don't want to be involved in. There's also, I think, a very important part of the profession that feels didn't necessarily want to get into the weeds of the First Amendment argument, but nonetheless felt, why should we live in a world where the government has to in any way be seen as endorsing a trademark that has an offensive message?
I understand, yes, yeah. So have you seen a spike in potentially disparaging trademark applications being filed or not particularly?
Well, the spike actually began a little bit beforehand. In other words, people anticipated this decision a year or so before it came down and started filing their applications, and they were all put in queue by the PTO, which said, you know, when we have a final decision from the Supreme Court, we'll deal with these. I don't really know. I know that a lot of people were very concerned with this spike and were very busy reporting on it for the first couple months around the time of the decision. I haven't heard much about it since. I think the novelty of applying for trademarks that have offensive words in them or disparaging words in them probably began to wear off pretty fast. U.S. trademark law, I'm sorry, the thing about American trademarks is that registration is only a form of perfecting what's deemed to be an existing right that accrues under the common law, and it accrues by virtue of use. Therefore, unlike in Europe, registration is not necessary to have trademark rights, and use is necessary to have trademark rights. Well,
right,
if you
yeah.
have to use your mark in commerce, and it's a mark that's likely to disparage someone, you're probably going to find yourself pretty unpopular pretty fast, notwithstanding the caricature of certain groups within political discourse. As a general rule, Americans in the 21st century don't approve of racial epithets. They don't approve of name calling. So you have to use that mark. Are you going to put a sign in your store that says, you know, some offensive name, or are you going to try to sell some offense, you know?
You're going to be pretty unpopular whether or not you have a trademark registration.
Right. So getting the registration, you know, it might be something that, if you're that kind of person and you want to impress your good old boy friends or your, you know, whatever it is your group is that likes to call other people names, you can get your registration and spend your couple hundred dollars on it. But at the end of the day, it's stupid. It's a waste of time. It's childish.
Understand.
On the other hand, people like my clients who really want to make a social statement and something that is contrary to that sort of mentality, but they're trying to actually affirm a sort of ethnic pride, they have the elbow room to do it now.
Right. So which aspect of the case did you find most challenging?
That's a great question. It was a little bit challenging. I mean, it was frustrating when we were doing the administrative appeals within the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Our Trademark Trial and Appeal Board is very able, very well respected. But it was clear to me at a certain point that they were not really open to arguments that we had to make about the application and that it would have to be decided by the courts. And that was, I didn't get into this expecting to spend 5-6 years and going up to the Supreme Court. I thought it would be resolved in the TTAB, and I thought it would be resolved on a much more mundane level, far short of invalidating part of a statute that's been in place for since well before I was born. Once it took off into the federal, into the appeals process, it took on a life of its own. And although there was a great deal of work required, we began to get a sense fairly early on that we were going to be the recipients of a sort of special treatment by the courts. Signals were there from the Federal Circuit when it reversed itself sua sponte after originally affirming the decision of the TTAB, which itself had affirmed the refusal to register. So frustration at that point, it was more on the sort of everyday aspect of getting things out and putting together the team and deciding who is going to argue and those sorts of things. But once we got out of the PTO and into the hands of the courts, it was frankly a great deal of fun.
That's good to hear. So before we wrap things up, are there any sort of behind-the-scenes anecdotes that you can tell us, anything funny that you can share with us about the case, something that's not...
Well, there are a number of things. It was very clear to us that a decision had sort of been made in the halls of justice, as I mentioned at the very beginning, that this was a better case to decide the constitutionality of Section 2A than the Redskins case, which was the case that everybody was paying attention to. When it became obvious that we were going to be the ones going up to the Supreme Court, my clients suddenly started getting calls from this sort of elite Supreme Court bar, which was trying to get in on what everyone, I think, who was really knowledgeable understood was going to be a win, and convincing them that they absolutely had to have one of these D.C. elite people involved, the New Jersey law firm, New York lawyers, which our firm at the time was overwhelmingly a New Jersey law firm, they were not considered to be regulars in the Supreme Court. And we had to, you know, look at it. Ultimately, it was the client's call at any time. He could have engaged anyone else. And we had to give him confidence that we could do it. We did get the help of the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA School of Law, Free Speech Supreme Court Clinic, which was fantastic for us. So we did have someone who would knew the Supreme Court ropes better than we did. But there came a point where the Washington Redskins attorneys, who were very helpful to us in the process, saw our advocacy in this case as a possible threat to their appeal because they didn't think we could pull it off properly. And, you know, when certiorari was granted by the Supreme Court, they approached us and said, okay, time for us to handle this Lance case. We said, what? No, listen, you guys, you did a good job getting it this far, but this is too important for you to handle. You, the Supreme Court doesn't know you. There's some very complex issues here involving commercial speech and content neutrality. And, you know, I hung up the phone. You know, my head was spinning. They actually asking me to let me. Well, we let's just say politely declined their offer. Rest was history.
Yeah, you won. So history proved you right. Okay, well, Ronald, thank you very much for some very, very interesting insights in what's been one of the biggest landmark cases we've seen in the trademark profession for a long time. And I hope
we get
again on our podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again at the next Trademark Lawyers conference or under some other happy circumstances. All the best to you.
Thanks, Ronald. Bye.
Bye.